Hello, I'm Elena Del Valle, and this is the HispanicNPR.com podcast. My guest today is Paul Hargraves, who is CEO of Cotswold Fair. We will discuss Beyond B Corp. Paul is a speaker, author, and B Corp ambassador. According to his bio, he's one of the leading voices in the United Kingdom seeking to encourage and inspire businesses to make a positive impact on the world, and believes businesses should be a force for good, which is the title of his first book. Paul believes that to bring the radical and systemic change required to reverse climate change and the growing inequality in the world, a new compassionate, loving, servant-hearted leadership is required. This is what he calls the fourth bottom line, which is also the title of his second book. Paul, welcome.
Good to be here. Looking forward to this.
Paul, would you share your conflict of interest with us? Who do you represent for purposes of our discussion today?
I don't represent anyone but myself. And wanting to spread the word of good business.
Let's start with a real basic question. What are we talking about when we say B Corp?
So B Corps are businesses that are a force for good. The concept started in the US actually in 2006. So I'll try and make this as brief and as simple as I can. So in effect, there's three elements to being a B Corp. Number one, or four actually. So number one, you have to be a for-profit business. Number two, you have to have changed your legal entity of your company. In the UK, we have all companies are registered by the government, and there's something called company articles, which basically is the legal bit of a company, and most businesses are set up to only exist for the benefit of their shareholders. B Corps have to change that, and they exist for the benefit of all stakeholders, which is the shareholders amongst them, but it's also the workers, your local community, the environment, your supply chain, customers, suppliers, etc. Thirdly, there's a fairly rigorous certification process involving loads and loads of questions in five different areas: governance, workers, community, environment, and customers. The number of questions you get depends on how big your business is and how complex it is, but for us it's about 230 questions, and you have to get a certain number of points from all those questions and get over a line, which happens to be 80 points, but that's don't worry about that. You don't need to be perfect by any means, but you need to get enough points in the different areas. You also need to prove everything you say you're doing. You have to prove that you're doing it, and anyone can go onto the B Impact website and put in the company details and get an idea of where they're at. And the final thing is to produce an impact report every year, which in effect says what you've done as a business to benefit the world in those five different areas over the past year. And that's really it. Obviously, it's a lot more complicated than that, but I've tried to keep it simple.
What does the B stand for?
That's a good question, because a lot of people think it stands for benefit, because in some ways you are saying you're a business that is benefiting the world, but it doesn't actually stand for anything. It's just most businesses are on plan A and this is plan B, different way of doing it. That's the only thing the B stands for.
It's a pretty big change in outlook, what you're describing. What is the driver?
Well, for me, I mean, I've always wanted, I mean, I came from, I'm probably slightly different in this respect, but I came from the charitable sector, which I'd worked in there for about 10 to 12 years. So when I started a business, which kind of started by accident as a kind of sideline business, and then there came a point in 1999 where it had to turn into a proper business. I was always wanting to run a business that somewhat in some way helped people. So of our first few employees, we had recovering drug addict, we have a recovering alcoholic, and we have someone who just come out of prison. So right at the beginning, that was part of our DNA. I guess for businesses more recently that are becoming B Corps, I think there's been a sense, I think, over the last few years, started with the economic crash in 2008, and then COVID, I think, made people realize that the way we've done things in the kind of capitalist setup isn't working terribly well. It's certainly not working for the poorer end of society. It's certainly not working for the planet. We've got to do things better in a way that improves the world, rather than what business has done over many years is actually extract from the planet, extract from people, and we've left the place in not a very good way. So I think there's a growing sense in which businesses should be contributing and making society better and helping to reverse climate change, and that's a growing movement, really. There's not every business by any means yet, but there is certainly a higher percentage of businesses that are business leaders that want to leave a positive legacy with their business and not just make themselves and the other shareholders loads of money.
How does that process begin? Does it have to be someone like you that when you started, you already had a different, certainly from the mainstream idea? Do you have to already be that person, or are you converting people? How does that work?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think a lot of people have, I mean, it's probably a bit of a myth that all business people are in it for themselves. I think, you know, over the years, I've met a lot of genuinely good people who are treating their people well. I mean, it's never been rocket science, has it? If you treat the people that work for you really, really well, you'll end up with a great business and probably increase your revenue and profits better anyway. So I think there's a sense in which it's something in their heart of hearts people wanted to do. They may not necessarily have known how to do it and how to be a business that's benefiting the world. And that, you know, that's the case for me. My heart was probably always in the right place, as many other people. But the B Corp kind of process, if you like, has helped us work out where we could be better, has helped us realize actually the areas where we're not doing terribly well, and has helped us improve in those areas. So, yes, we definitely spread the word in terms of our suppliers. For example, we've got about 450 suppliers, and I think now there's about 80 that are also B Corps that have become so over the last few years. But, yeah, I mean, it is part of the process, and I think it's part of the changing world we live in. Certainly in the UK, there's quite a lot of disillusionment amongst customers, the general public, of business and how it's treated people, how it's treated the planet. So in some cases, doing this stuff is actually the best thing to do for business anyway. You're more likely to get certain customers to buy from you. You're more likely to get local government contracts if you're putting sustainability front and center in your life. So, yeah, there are some people that are jumping on the bandwagon and probably don't have the right motivation, but I'm not worrying too much about them. I'm just pleased that generally business is moving forward in the right direction. Does that make sense?
Yes. I'm wondering, as the, you know, sitting on the outside and looking at the description, how is that different from just saying you are a good person at heart and you're doing well by your stockholders and or your stakeholders, your partners, yeah, whoever owns the business? You're treating your employees as well as you can. How is being a B Corp different than that?
I think it adds a lot more into that. So the workers, certainly for us, and probably for quite a few of my friends who are also running B Corps, the workers area is probably the area we were best at before we started to change things. It certainly opened our eyes to be a better business for our local community. And since we've been a B Corp, we do a lot more in the community. As a company, we pay people to do volunteering in the local community, and they have to do a certain number of hours a year. And probably more than any other area, is the environmental side of things. We probably weren't terribly good, or we weren't thinking about the right things in terms of being better for the environment. So the assessment has definitely helped us move forward in that area to think about things more carefully, such as packaging, carbon, water use, electricity, gas, etc. So, and the other good thing about being a B Corp is obviously there's always businesses that are better than you that you can learn from and take the best practice from other business and try and apply that into your own business. So the community side of being a B Corp is quite important because there's no point reinventing the wheel the whole time. If we see a good idea that another business is doing, I think, well, fantastic, this could really work for us, and we'll nick the idea and unashamedly steal it and put it into our business too.
I've seen companies that say, that, for example, with a volunteerism, that they're doing that, but in fact, what they're doing is they're bullying more time away from their employees, families, and private lives by forcing them to volunteer time because they're not getting paid anymore.
Well, no, these hours do it in their normal working day. So they, instead of coming to the office, they go and volunteer, and we pay them to do it. So it's not more time. It's time they would have been sitting in an office. They're now volunteering.
So it's real,
Oh
not.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and the reason we do it, A, obviously it's a good thing to do, but B, and when I've, as I said at the beginning, I come from that world, so I know. From the volunteering I've done, actually, it does me good as a human being to see people who are less fortunate than me, and to serve other people less fortunate than me. So, and that's it massively helped me as a person be a better person, be more grateful for what I've got, help me have compassion for other people. So it's, I mean, I could say. We do it for selfish reasons. If you wanted to say, put an angle on it, you could say, well, actually, I'm improving the people whose lives who work for us, and actually, it makes them better employees anyway through the volunteering. So it is absolutely a win-win. Yes, we're doing something for community, but every time you reach out to the community and do something, then you get paid back in terms of, better experience in life. And one of our projects is in Africa. I've had a picture of some of the kids that have just come up on my computer as I'm talking to you, which is slightly weird, isn't it? But so we take teams over there, and that constitutes as part of people's volunteering time. And they all think they're going over there to help the poor kids in Kenya, which we are doing, definitely. We've contributed a lot to this particular village that we go to. But the people I take in the teams actually are probably more getting helped than the children in Africa, because it's just good for us all, isn't it, to see people who have absolutely nothing and to realize we live in a world where, if you're in the UK or the US, you're generally most likely to be in the top 5% of the world's wealthiest people. So, yeah, it is. I mean, it absolutely works both ways. So it does us good, it does the community good, and it's a win-win for everyone.
What are the ethical guidelines that you follow? I've spoken with people in some of these places that you describe, some of whom are or have been beneficiaries of programs like the ones that you describe, and I've heard mixed impressions. Some of them feel that outsiders coming to their communities are making them feel inadequate, are making them feel poor. are making them feel that they don't have access to things that they never thought they needed to be happy or to live a fulfilling life. So where are those guidelines? What are the ethical guidelines that this program follows in deciding how you go about? Because what's good for one person may be interference or even harmful to another.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really valid point. I don't think anyone's ever asked me this question before, but yes, I mean, obviously, I think if you go with the attitude of serving, and yes, we do, you know, put certain rules in place. So if I'm taking females in the team, they have to dress, you know, similarly to the culture that would there, for example. I think if you're going to serve, I mean, what we end up doing is mainly doing teaching and lessons in the schools. We've got primary school and a secondary school there, and helping them with their English, which in Kenya is a massive advantage if they can speak better English. So I think there are well-known cases and celebrities have, you know, basically been going really for the PR side of it. That's not, you know, that's not good. It's appalling, actually. But I think if you're going and your heart is to serve the people you're trying to help, I think it's very difficult to go wrong.
Some people, stateside or in many of the developed world, who are struggling themselves, we're seeing record numbers of homeless people in the United States. I've seen on the news that this is an issue in the United Kingdom as well. Some people might say that we need help domestically before dedicating resources to other continents. What guidelines do you use to make those decisions?
Most of our help does go to the UK, actually, because obviously not everyone. If people go and do the work in Kenya, they've got to pay for their own air ticket to get there, and obviously involves a lot more time. So, yeah, 95% of the volunteering we do, and probably about 80% of the giving that we do is to exactly what you say. We work very closely with two or three different food bank projects in the UK, and you're spot on. Food bank usage has gone up 10 times in the last 10 years, which is pretty horrendous. So, yeah, I mean, most of, and we have the way we give money, we have a charitable trust that's linked to the company, and the rules for that are that the trustees of the charity have to outnumber the number of people from the company that are on the trustees. So in effect, they're independent people that are having the sway on the decisions we made in terms of who we give money to. And there's proper procedures in place in terms of doing the research, in terms of what the money is going to be used for. And then they have to do a report in terms of how the money was actually spent. So we make sure 100% is actually spent in the right places. Does that answer your question?
Certainly in part. One of the issues that we're seeing here in places who have been trying to do good, San Francisco comes to mind, but they're by no means the only place. A number of urban centers, Chicago, New York, I think Seattle, I think Portland, have all been having issues with attracting people who are not local, who are coming from other states, sometimes across the country, because of the benefits that are on offer. Sometimes they get free housing, they get a monthly stipend. There's been a whole industry of nonprofits who have popped up to support this system because this is where the money is. Have you looked at that, and how do you counter that? How do you deal with it? And they're struggling with that They're struggling with drugs that are popping up in some places that have made drug use legal, and with the entirety of the industry that has developed to take advantage of this money that is now available for homeless people and hungry people.
Yeah, I mean, I know the issues in San Francisco. My brother lives not too far from there, so yeah, I'm well aware of that. I mean, obviously, what we're doing is on a very small scale, but what you say is a good example, I think, of the need for legislation and business have to. You know, it's no good to some degree. We can only do good as a business up to a certain level. At some point, there has to be legislation. Otherwise, things do get out of control, or we'll just hit the buffers and we won't be able to do what we want to do. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think any time you give money or do volunteering, there's always going to be an element of some people taking advantage. But I don't think that's a reason not to do it.
No, I didn't mean not to do it. I was saying, how much advanced thinking are you putting into deciding what good is? Because good can get very complicated. For example, if you look at the issue of pets, we now have situations where the shelters are bursting at the seams with abandoned or feral cats and dogs, and now they're asking taxpayers for more funding. Here in Florida, for example, they need to air condition the buildings, and there's excess capacity. And then you have people who are traveling to other states or other countries to rescue pets and bringing them to places where they have no-kill shelters. But now you have a burden on those communities for pets that were not local in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds completely out of control, doesn't it? Yeah, I mean, our brief in terms of our charitable trust is fairly limited. So there's two purposes. It's alleviation of poverty and creating a better environment. So the projects we support have to fulfill one of those two objectives, and what we're doing is a drop in the ocean, but we're pretty good at monitoring what we do has the impact we want it to do. And if that whole thing grows, which I hope it does, we probably would have to put in more rules, if you like, in terms of how we monitored the success or otherwise of the projects we were supporting.
What is the oversight process like? The certification, to begin with, who is behind that? Is there a nonprofit? Is it a government entity? How does a company become certified?
Yeah, so there's a non-profit, I mean, I don't know if they're a registered charity, but they're certainly non-profit organization called B-Lab, which have offices in loads of different countries in the world. And then they use independent auditors to audit all the companies that are applying for the B Corp certification. As I said, it is a pretty rigorous process, and there's about three different levels of checking that go on in terms of looking at people's evidence. So yes, in some ways I would say it's probably more rigorous than it was when we first certified. And you have to recertify every 3 years. So, and the bar actually gets higher each year. So it's no good saying, okay, we've made it now, we're gonna relax. No, you'll have to carry on improving and getting better, because in 3 years' time, you'll be reassessed again and the standards have actually increased. So it's no good standing still. You've got to carry on moving forward. And that was I think initially a bit of a shock when I found that out, because I didn't know until we certified. But actually now I think that's probably one of the best things about it, because it forces continuous change and improvement.
What does it mean for the company itself? I mean, you as a for-profit have to stay profitable, and this is costing you out of pocket to be certified and out of pocket to pay for your employees to volunteer time. What is the benefit? Is there a financial, a bottom line benefit?
Well, I would say yes. I mean, I think most businesses run out of a scarcity model, which in effect means, well, whatever you spend money on doing good, if you like, that comes off the bottom line. But I think that's quite a limiting view of it. And if you look at most religions in the world, they all have a kind of principle of if you give, you'll get it back. And that's certainly true for us. It seems that the more generous we are to the people that work for us, the more generous we are to the community, the more we do for the environment, we do actually get it back. And one way we get it back is increasingly consumers want to spend money with companies like us, because they know that they also need to make a difference. So if they got a choice of buying a product from a company like us they could get elsewhere, quite a few people, an increasing number of people, will choose to spend money with us. So that's kind of how we get it back, I would say. Yes, we need to make a profit, but profit isn't the goal. It's like when you get up in the morning, you don't think, right, my aim today is to breathe. So it's like as a company, we don't think our aim is to make profit. Our aim is to do good, do what we can, grow the business, and the sideline of that is the profit. It's a bit like when you get into your day, you're thinking of what you're going to do that day. You're not going to thinking of breathing. But yes, you need breath. You need the profit for businesses to survive and carry on and do more good.
One of the areas where we're seeing a lot of changes stateside, and I don't know how prevalent that is in the UK and in Europe, is in our food supply. Increasingly, many of the produce is being imported, sometimes from very far away places. I just bought turmeric from Fiji the other day. Sometimes the shelf stable food itself is, or oftentimes, ultra processed, and we're seeing a direct impact on people's health.
Yeah.
How do you approach that? You're in the food business, right?
Yeah. In fact, I ran a seminar the other day called Transforming the UK Food Sector, and so a bit of research I did for that. I think in the US, and the same is true here as well, for people in their 20s, 2/3 of what they were eating was ultra-processed foods. I don't know if you've heard the same stats as that, but yeah, it's horrendous. So we are in a business of specialty food. It's all, you know, generally artisanal, made by hand. 90% of what we sell is British. We only import things that we can't either make in the UK or can't grow in the UK. So we're trying to, you know, that is a important part of our business, an important part of our doing good, is to try and get people to eat better and eat food that has travelled less before they put it in their mouth. So that's definitely an important point that you've touched on there for sure.
Are there a lot of other food sellers among your B Corp brethren?
Yes, so in the UK, I can't speak for other countries in the world, but certainly in the UK, the food and drink sector is actually the highest represented industry within UK B Corps. So I think about 20% of the UK B Corps, which is about 2,000 companies, are businesses that are connected with the food and drink industry in some way. Either they're making food, they're selling it, or they're running retail or hospitality businesses. So that's good. Obviously, we'd like it to like there to be more. In terms of our supplier base, we've got about 80 of our suppliers are B Corps, as for about 450. So that's, I think, about 20%. Again, we'd like it to be higher, but it's a lot higher than it was a few years back. So, yes, things are moving. And also, yes, I would like them to move faster, because the challenge is certainly here, and the same would be, I mean, I know some people that run food businesses in the US too. The kind of good quality products are generally costing a bit more than the lower quality ultra processed food. So we're fighting against a system in which, you know, I don't want to run a business where it's only the top 10% earners can buy the products we sell. They should be available to everyone. And you've got a situation where, you know, it is only the top 10% that can afford the really good quality foods that isn't ultra processed. So again, we're in a system that is broken, but we are doing what we can, which will involve lobbying governments at some point to try and get the system to change. I mean, the government basically listens to the industries that are churning out all this food that isn't good for people, and they're not changing the rules to make it, you know, make it like sugar content or salt content in food having a certain level. So unfortunately, governments here and in the US tend to listen to the big companies who are making huge profits from selling people unhealthy food, and that will have to change at some point.
Well, the ultra-processed foods, as I understand it, are engineered in labs by food scientists to taste, I don't know if the word is irresistible, but certainly
yeah.
compelling.
Addictive. I think addictive is the word. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One of the concepts that strikes me just anecdotally is when I speak with people and this comes up, they are incredulous. They think that this is an exaggeration, and if it tastes good, then their palates are must be telling them that this is good. And so therefore, as with organic foods, oftentimes many people think that it's not worth paying more for organic foods, because after all, a tomato is a tomato, an apple is an apple. What does it matter?
Yeah, you say that, but try, if you taste a tomato that you've grown in our garden, which we do here, compared to one in the supermarket, the taste is incomparable. The garden-grown tomato actually tastes of tomato, whereas the supermarket one tastes of nothing. So there is, in some areas, there's definitely a taste difference.
Well, and my understanding is that now someone has measured the nutrients in the tomatoes that
yeah.
you're eating there, right? That we're eating here in supermarkets, and the ones that taste better have more nutrients. Have you heard about that?
No, I haven't actually, no. But that doesn't surprise me.
The theory is that things taste better because we have evolved to taste food, to develop a taste, or we have developed a taste as a humans have developed a taste for foods that are nutritious. So we like that
yeah.
tomato because it's good for us.
Mm. But then these food scientists are basically trying to kid our taste buds with chemicals to make us think that these foods are better for us than aren't. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Well, what they've done, as I understand it, you're the food specialist, but from what I understand, the growers of certain foods, tomatoes are in that category. Apparently watermelons, which was news to me, they have maximized foods that will remain stable for long periods of time without going off, so tomatoes, watermelons, and other produce. But in exchange, there's been a loss of nutrient content and flavor. And so now they have discovered, what a concept, that people will pay more for produce. This includes a variety of produce, citrus and apples, tomatoes, I think strawberries or berries. There's a company in the US now that is, I think, the largest producer of strawberries and berries. And they are now, or have launched, a line of these products that are considered premium. So you pay more for them, but they
Yeah.
taste better.
Pay more for something that it should be everywhere anyway. It's completely mad, isn't it?
And
I mean,
so,
certainly in the UK, there's definitely a lot more people. Well, obviously not possible in cities, although quite a few of our cities have allotments. But there are, certainly since COVID, actually, there's a lot more people growing their own fruit and veg now than there was before. So I think that's a step in the positive direction, because some people have realized, actually, what I've been eating for all these years, why? It tastes terrible compared to these nice fruit and veg that I'm growing in my allotment. So yeah, but it's sad, isn't it, that you people are being made to pay a premium for something that all the strawberries should taste like that, not just the premium ones.
it's astonishing because I think what happens over time is that some people never tasted strawberries like that.
No, that's right.
So they don't know any different. This is all they've ever had.
Yeah, but you touched on it in what you said. A lot of the reason for that is due to the huge miles that food is being transported. So they've got to do something to it to make it last long enough. If more people ate local food, then that problem goes away, doesn't it? Because it's being picked one day and you're eating it the next. If it's coming from, if you're getting something from, well, turmeric's not a good example, but if you're getting strawberries from South Africa, which we do in this country at certain times of the year, that's a very, very long way from the UK. So your normal strawberry isn't going to be edible by the time it gets to the UK and gone through all the permutations of the supply chain. So yeah, local food is part of the answer here.
We're getting citrus from South Africa in our grocery stores now.
Yeah, we probably do too, yeah. Because obviously their seasons are opposite to ours. We can't grow citrus in the UK anyway. So I think in the summer it comes from Spain, and then probably in the winter it comes from the southern hemisphere.
To go back to the good and the how do you balance, how do you manage that? Are people aware that this is better, that this is good for them, or are they just looking for the cheapest possible price point?
Well, things are tight and tough at the moment. So, yeah, 90% of the population probably are only shopping on price, sadly. But that's partly because, I mean, if people, as a percentage of people's income, people in the 60s paid far more on food than they do now. And far more, you could shop in our most expensive customer and still be paying less than the percentage of your income than you were in the 60s. But people have got used to buying really cheap food. Land is an issue. Rents are far too high. If you've got a mortgage, it's a percentage a lot higher as a percentage of your income than it was in the 60s. So the whole balance of living has changed. So most people in the UK, and probably true in the US too, can't afford the good food they need to eat to be healthy. So that's what I'm talking about with the systemic change we've got to see. We've got to see some government legislation at some point if we're going to break this broken system. We're going to change the broken system, rather.
Tell us more about this systemic change. How far should government intervene? Because we're also seeing situations where government intervention can become toxic, certainly when it's a very politicized environment.
Yeah. Well, we did say we weren't going to get into politics, but So either more and more businesses are existing for the benefit of all stakeholders like us, which would be a huge shift for the majority of businesses to be like that, or we're going to have to do things differently. I mean, I'm not an economist, but there is some economists that think that the way forward is to pay a universal basic wage to everyone, you know, rich, poor, middle. And obviously at the rich end, they would, you know, pay a lot of that back in tax, whereas at the poor end, they would then have enough money to be able to live better. So I don't know how the modelling works with all that, but there are people coming up with various schemes that could change things for better. I don't know. I'm just a humble CEO. I don't really know too much about politics or economics. And I do get fairly frustrated and stressed by some of this stuff some of the time, particularly running up to elections. But I think I've learnt a better way of looking at these things is that, look, I can only influence my area of influence. I can influence and help improve the lives of the 140-odd people that work for me. I can help improve my local community. I can help the aspects in which our business touches the environment and do something there. We can, if we all did that and all did our small bit we can do, we would see a seismic shift, I think, in society.
How do customers, maybe there are companies where customers are fewer than, say, in a food business, but how do customers, anyone who interacts with a B Corp, how do they know that it's a B Corp? And if they want to find one, say someone's listening to our conversation, says, well, is there somebody in my circle? Is there somebody around me? Do you have a store near me, etc.? How do they find them?
Well, more and more people making B Corps making products, more and more of them are putting the logo on the product these days. And they, in the UK, the brand awareness of B Corp is, I think, running about 35%, so that's a lot higher than it was a few years ago. So there is some brand recognition, but that's one answer to the question. I mean, our main business is B2B. It's a bit more difficult for people to notice how different we are in that, because a lot of the interactions we have with customers is via email and website, and then, you know, they get their deliveries. But we have also got to retail sites, and it was really interesting actually when we first opened our first retail site, which was about 3 years ago. My kids, who were grown up in their 20s, came for lunch soon after it opened, and they, you know, these are children that have been involved in the business for various things over the years. They've helped out when it's been busy, they've done their work experience there and stuff like that. But when they came to the retail business, which has a large restaurant as well, they were having lunch, and they said, Dad, people here seem really happy, don't they? And it was like, finally, after all these years, the penny has dropped. So a lot of people comment when they come into our retail business that it feels different, and they feel welcomed and they feel part of it. So there is a kind of practical answer to your question, but I think there's also a kind of atmospheric or even spiritual answer to it as well, that people do notice a difference where people are doing things better.
It's a little bit mystical.
That's a good word, yeah. Yeah. I like that. Might use it.
I would like to find food like the food that you're describing, other than flying to the United Kingdom.
Well, you're welcome any time, of
Yeah,
course. But
it would be very expensive shopping.
it would. But you could have a holiday as well at the same time. But yeah, I mean there are retail businesses in the US that are B Corp, so I'm sure they're similar to us. So there is if you want to find a business like that, all the B Corps all over the world are all registered on a database on the B Corp website, so you can just type in your country or your area and then the type of business you're looking for, and it'll bring up all the ones local to you. So definitely a good thing to do if you're looking for those good businesses to spend money with.
Are all B Corps created equal, for lack of a better phrasing?
Don't really know what you mean by that.
I'm saying I would like to shop at your shop or the retail outlet that you have. It sounds lovely. I would like to buy strawberries that taste like strawberries.
Yeah, I mean that each B Corp will have an area that they're particularly good at. So yeah, I mean, are they all equal? I mean, there'll be different aspects of different businesses that will be stand out. So I would say we're obviously good at food, but we're also good at looking at people in the hospitality industry and retail industry in the UK aren't very well treated on the whole. So I think we're really good at how we treat people, and that does come across in customer service. Other businesses may be better than us in terms of their environmental side, and you might notice that in a different way. So no, they're not all equal. They all have reached a standard, but they will all have still strengths and weaknesses in different areas.
So, say for a completely different example, if I'm looking for a hospital, if I'm looking for an assisted living facility, if I'm looking for a surgical center, can I trust that if they're on that list, they're okay? Because there are a lot of problems here, especially this has become very obvious during
Yeah.
the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean they're going to be much better than average. So that score, which is a bit meaningless to you and your listeners, because you don't know the process, but the pass mark for being a B Corp is 80, and it's out of 200. And even the best B Corp is only about 150. So that gives an idea. But the average business in the US and the UK is about 50 points. So you've got to be 80 to be a B Corp, and many, like us, were about 120. So many are higher than that. So, yes, I could safely say that they're going to be a lot better than the average business in their sector.
How do you measure the results internally for your own business? You were saying earlier that since you became a B Corp, you're confident that you're doing better on the bottom line. Are you actually measuring? Have you looked at what has happened to you as a business since you became a B Corp?
In terms of the profitability, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, revenue and profit are, I mean, it's quite a long time ago now, but obviously, we've grown a lot in that time. So our revenue is about three times what it was when we certified, and the profit is, I think, about 2.5 times what it was back then. So yeah. It's both. I mean, I've got a nice graph I use in my presentations which shows exactly that, and the graph curves line, or whatever you want to call it, goes a lot more steeply up after we became a big, not immediately actually, but after a couple of years, the growth curve has been a lot stronger. It took us a couple of years to kind of embed this stuff, actually. That's the reason for that. So, yeah, I mean, it was driven by me initially, and I would say it probably took 2 years for the DNA of all the changes we're making to thoroughly get embedded in the business.
And I was going to say, is there a change period when you and your staff and your customers have to adapt to changes? Because obviously this implies some change in direction and practices, right?
Yeah. I mean, some people have left because they didn't feel part of it, which is also fine. We didn't want them there either. But the big change now is, as we've grown, obviously we've taken on people, and more people are coming to us because of what we stand for. And actually, in these, I don't know if it's the same in the US at the moment, but there's still about 1 million job vacancies in the UK. So it's very much a seller's market in terms of the people looking for jobs. They can choose wherever they want to go, actually. So more and more the good people are choosing to work for businesses like ours because, you know, they can get paid well and also make a difference through their job. So we're much, much better at attracting really good people than we were before.
Are B Corp companies competitive when it comes to benefits and salaries, wages?
Yeah, I would say so. Yes. I mean, generally the benefits are a lot better. Salaries would be, certainly in our case, average for our sector. But benefits a lot better. I mean, we do things like sabbaticals, we give more holiday, we give people extra days off when it's a birthday, for example. So we do private healthcare, which I know is a standard thing in the US, it's not in the UK. So we do loads and loads of things, more than average businesses in the UK.
Well, in this period, we're certainly seeing a lot of issues with wages and employees unionizing or unions going on strike. We currently have a strike going on and two major strikes that I can think of off the top of my head. Mm. Is this something that is present among B Corps or does that disappear?
No, I mean, the striking in the UK is generally tends to be public service workers. It doesn't really happen in the private sector anyway. But, yeah, I mean, B Corps generally would involve... I mean, there's a lot of B Corps in the UK that are employee-owned businesses. Some of our employees have shares, not all yet, but I'd like to get to there. So, but even if they're not, they would generally be businesses where employees have a lot more say in terms of how the companies run because that's better for business.
What is Beyond B Corp?
So, I mean, my kind of the danger of B Corp, again, because it's becoming so popular, is that there may be some bandwagon jumping and people do a box-ticking exercise and get over the line without really changing the culture. So in terms of being beyond B Corp, I think if we really are going to make a difference, it's not just about, oh, okay, we've got a different set of rules now that we're following, we're doing things better. I mean, I think this is a good place to start, don't get me wrong. But if we're going to really change and really make an impact on the world, we've got to understand more our interconnectedness with nature, interconnectedness with people all over the world in terms of how what we do in our businesses impacts on, you know, poorer countries in the world. We've already talked about that with food. And, you know, in some cases, we'll have to be paying higher prices so they can have a better standard of living. We may have to change the products we buy where the farming is being done in a more environmentally friendly way. So I don't think we're going to get there if we're just ticking boxes. I think it's got to be a deeper change than that. It's got to be at a heart and soul level rather than just a mind level, if you want to put it that way. I mean, a big turning point for me was in, I think it was about 2018, and I was talking to an audience of business leaders about the triple bottom line, so people, planet, profit. And I put a slide up on the screen that I'd used several times before, and it was a picture of people in Bangladesh who'd wading waist deep in water. They'd been flooded out of their homes. I put this slide on the screen to, you know, demonstrate the impact of climate change in other parts of the world. And I just started weeping on the stage, which was really embarrassing at the time. It never happened before. And anyway, managed to pull myself together and carry on. But afterwards, I was trying to work out what on earth was happening there. And what it was for the first time, you know, I'd probably seen climate change and environmental stuff in terms of facts and figures up to that point. But that was the point for me where I actually connected it with people and people's lives being destroyed by the damage we're doing to the planet. So it was a bit of a eureka moment for me, and it certainly has made me a lot more passionate ever since, because I'm not just trying to do this stuff with my mind. My emotions, my soul, if you want to use that kind of word, is more connected with the impact that we're having on different parts of the world through our businesses.
If one of the criteria that you're using is the impact that we have on the planet, where does growth come in? Because we certainly in the developed world, or certainly in the capitalistic world, are driven by never-ending growth models.
Yeah,
we can't grow forever. I mean, if you think about the policies that we have, the financial policies of inflation that's 2% a year, that is based on forever growth.
Yeah, no, you're right. There's a lot of, again, economists who are thinking about this kind of stuff think that we need to... It's the measure of success for most countries in the world, isn't it? Growth. GDP.
Yes.
How big is your GDP? And it's... you're right. We can't go on like that. So we need to have different ways of measuring whether a country is successful, and it isn't growth. It's probably wellness of human beings, I would suggest. Now, in terms of our business, we are growing, but we're not. I think it does depend on the products you're selling. We're not people. If our business grows, people aren't eating more. They're not buying more food. They're just buying better food and not buying it from other companies that maybe aren't selling such good products. And obviously with quite a lot of our profits gets invested back into the projects we've talked about already. So I'm perfectly happy sitting here being proud of a company that's growing, because I know that through our growth we're doing good, and we're not helping people consume more. But if you were, I don't know, if you were selling plastic toys and had a big target for growth, is that really making the world a better place? I don't think it is so much. But I'm probably seeing this from a very insular perspective. You can shoot me down if you want.
Well, but this is the beyond B Corp. This is at the heart of the question, is can you be a good citizen of the world? Can you respect nature? Can you respect the planet? Can you respect your fellow man with a model of growth that is infinite?
No, I don't think you can as a country, no. But I think businesses that are good, that are growing, can still be happy to grow. because all our profit from the last few years has all gone into starting new retail businesses, and we've employed another 100 people who now have a better job, better environment than they had before. So our measure of success isn't the growth, actually it's the impact of the growth that we're having, not the financial side. But in terms of a country growing its GDP every year, that isn't sustainable, no.
Even companies that are multinational, in some cases, they're taking consumerism to places where it didn't exist.
Yeah, and are those places better for us or not?
That's a big question, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I would probably say no in many cases. But, you know, that's based on my experience in Africa, primarily, and to some degree in Asia. But there's more pressure in some of those societies now because people who are perfectly happy with an old analog phone now have to have the latest smartphone, and as a result probably have a less good life as a result, because they're putting resources into buying that rather than doing the other things they were doing before.
Where should our listeners go to find out more about B Corps, whether it's because they themselves want to go through this process or because they want to do business with companies that have this kind of ethos, or because they want to shop from them?
Okay, so if you go to the B Corp website, just type B Corp into your search engine, and then there's an area of the B Corp website, this Find a B Corp, and you can put in the country you're living in and the industry you want to shop in, and it'll bring up on a map the B Corps local to you. And then if you type in B Impact Assessment, if you're a business leader or owner, and type B Impact Assessment into Google, you'll have to register, which doesn't cost anything. But you can register and start putting in some metrics about your business, and then you can have a look at the assessment process without any commitment whatsoever. But you could see the kind of questions you're going to get asked if you did decide to go through the B Corp certification process.
And you said that in order to be certified, you have to be a for-profit. Are there size limitations, too small,
nope,
too big?
No, there are B Corps that have zero employees. They're one woman companies or one man companies, and then there are obviously ones with thousands of employees. So no, you, in terms of if you did, yeah, the questions are different. Obviously if you haven't got any employees, you wouldn't get any points in the workers section, but you would get more points in other areas. So yeah, it is kind of balanced out based on the type of company you are.
Paul, thank you for joining us from a small village in the southwest of the United Kingdom.
It's been a pleasure to join you. I hope we can spread the ripples far and wide.
And to our audience, you have been listening to Paul Hargraves, who is CEO of Cotswold Fair, who discussed Beyond B Corp. To propose a guest for the show, you can email me directly at editor@hispanicmpr.com. That's editor@hispanicmpr.com.